There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again.
That's Gregory Peck portraying Harper Lee's character Atticus Finch in the 1962 film adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. The Duluth School District said this week that book and Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn will be removed from the required reading curriculum this coming fall. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we have reaction to that decision from Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Society and Abena Hutchville with the National Coalition Against Censorship. We reached out to the district's curriculum director, Michael Carey, and also Stefan Witherspoon, president of the Duluth chapter of the NAACP. Neither returned our request for an interview yesterday. In news reports, the district's curriculum director said the move was an effort to be considerate of all students and not marginalize them. The Duluth NAACP chapter president hailed the decision as long overdue, saying there are authors with, quote, better literature that can teach the same lessons without degrading people of color. Up first, we hear from Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Society about her thoughts on the move.
I'm not aware of all the particulars, but I understand that it's to make students of color more comfortable. And I agree with that. I agree with that, making our students, all of our students, more comfortable in school. But on the off side of that, there is the conversation about race, which is uncomfortable, and it should be uncomfortable at this moment so that we can look at different perspectives and understand where these roots are coming from and how these roots are embedded in our society and what it's going to take to change those thought patterns. The thing about these two books is, I grew up in the South. So I read these books, not because they were required reading in school, because they weren't. But I read these books in junior high school, and they were, for me, it gave me a new insight into things that I hadn't really thought about before as regarding to race and relationships with kids and adults. And I think that kind of, I think they kind of opened up the questions for me regarding racial issues, because it wasn't too long after I read those books that I had my first experience with a negative racial issue with some kids down there. What I think regarding their decision to do it, I'm glad they're not banning the books, which then I would have to take a big, you know, no, let's, we don't ban books, because for us, in this country, we need to be able to look at our history, all aspects of it, the good and the bad, study it, and use it as guides so we don't repeat those mistakes. In that respect, I think these books need to remain in the library and accessible to the students.
So what's the difference you see between removing it from the curriculum and banning them?
Banning books is, basically, when you start banning books, the next step is burning books, and that's just something that's straight out of fascism or a denial of context. It's a denial of, you know, just intelligent thought, you know, education. My biggest concern is not developing a head-in-the-sand mentality because we're afraid to confront the use of words, the use of vernacular in literature. Okay, I've read several books, including Malcolm X's autobiography, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, and even a lot of African American authors today still use the N-word in context of the books they are writing, in context of the historical value, in context of the societal value that we place on that word. And it's not all the time used to describe, you know, us today, but it's something that happened. It's a part of our history. That word is a part of our history. It's a part of our social makeup. It's a part of American vernacular and American social culture. I don't like the word. I don't agree with the word, and I'd love to see it disappear, but in order to disappear that word, completely, we'd have to go back and rewrite all of these books, rewrite how we think about history. That could be a good thing. It also could be a bad thing. You know, it's a slippery slope as far as that's concerned. You know, I really don't know how else to put that. I mean, like I said, from a scholarly standpoint, I don't necessarily agree that removing books like this is a good thing, but banning them would be worse.
So the important thing for you is that, you know, we're still having conversations, whether it's in our educational institutions or out in the community, about racism and discrimination in an open dialogue.
Yes. And several of my comments on social media regarding this are, you know, make sure the books are kept in the library, which we know now that's going to happen. The books are going to be kept in the library. And I myself think they should be used as reference and research options, reading options, not required reading. They should be used in their context and be compared to modern literature, modern fiction, modern historical documentations of regarding those times, regarding the social issues that were happening then that are relevant and comparable to what's happening today.
Well, comparable to what's happening today, you know, how should schools be having conversations in the classroom about race, about discrimination?
Well, first of all, we need to have our teachers trained on talking about that, about on facilitating those conversations, or we need to be bringing in people from the communities who have that knowledge, who do that every day, who talk about racism, who introduce and facilitate to people how to introduce those subjects with your kids, how to talk about it with students, how to talk about it in different groups, you know, mixed race groups, mixed gender groups, because those books aren't just, they don't just have some connotations that are negative towards people of color. There's also connotations in those books regarding rape culture, regarding the unbelief of women who accuse people of rape. They also have connotations in there regarding the lies that were told by many white women in those eras that caused a lot of men, a lot of black men to be lynched and killed. You know, so those contexts need to be taken into account. That still happens today.
I guess I just wanted to circle back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, understanding that this decision was made to make students more comfortable in the classroom. But yet at the same time, we're hearing that we need to have uncomfortable conversations. So how do you how do you juxtapose those two things together? How do you balance that out?
We have been balancing those out for decades and years in the conversations about race. And it's a learning game. It's a continual learning game on how you juxtapose that. I mean, how do we juxtapose white people's feelings and sensitivity about talking about race with the hard conversations and facts that we have to present to them about race, about privilege, about understanding and acceptance of different cultures and people that don't look like you? It's hard, you know, but one of the biggest things that can help happen with that and should happen is training. I was in the eighth grade before I read this book, so that gives you a little bit better understanding. When I read To Kill a Mockingbird, Huckleberry Finn, I read earlier, and yeah, I had questions about it then, and I talked to my mom about it, and you know, at that time, it was, oh, that was just the way it was, that was the time it was, and who wrote the book. You know, nowadays, yeah, we have to understand and teach our kids about the thought processes that happened back then so that they can understand why this is wrong. But they also need to understand how this type of literature, media presentation, and word of mouth went around to make the racism that we experience today, how it set it in stone. Did that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. You're saying that basically what's presented in the book is a snapshot in time that shows the thought process around what the book is based on, it still exists in society, right?
I mean, we still talk about Clayton Jackson McGee. That happened back in 1920. Is it relevant today? Yes, because in a sense, black men are still being lynched, you know, by police, by society, by the justice system. There's a correlation. We can still see it. Are women still lying about being raped? Yes, that happened. How does that affect real victims? How does that affect victims coming forward? How does that affect the women who are raped? Or how does it affect the lives of people, of the men who were, you know, who were accused falsely? It still happens. There's still relevancy. The N-word is still used. It's used in popular culture. It's used in our music. It's used in our writing. It's used on TV. You know, we still use it. So if we're going to be offended because it was written in a book almost 70 years ago, then we need to be offended that it's being presented to our children in social media. It's being presented to our children in hip-hop culture. It's being presented to our children in many different forms in this day, and it's more disseminated because their friends, black, white, other, are saying that word to each other. So it's ingrained in our society, and part of the understanding needs to be that this was how it became ingrained in our society, through written word, through word of mouth. So there's things that we can learn from these books. It's just how it's disseminated.
Again, that was Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Society. Again, we reached out to the Duluth School District's Curriculum Director Michael Carey and Duluth NAACP Chapter President Stefan Witherspoon, but neither returned requests for an interview yesterday. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll hear from Abena Hutchful with the National Coalition Against Censorship. The organization has urged the district to reconsider its decision to remove those books from its required reading curriculum. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about reaction to a decision by Duluth Schools this week to remove Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird from required reading at the district. In news reports, the district's curriculum director said the move was an effort to be considerate of all students and not marginalize them. The Duluth NAACP chapter president hailed the decision as long overdue, saying there are authors with better literature that can teach the same lessons without degrading people of color. We reached out to both of them for an interview, but neither returned our requests. Up next, we hear from Abena Hutchville with the National Coalition Against Censorship. She says the organization is urging the district to reconsider its decision to remove the books from its required reading curriculum.
Well, we take an interest in every case where books are removed from classrooms or libraries because of the ideas that they express and not because of their educational suitability for students. One of the most important protections of the First Amendment is the right to access information and the freedom for students to read books in the classroom for their educational merit. And what we see happen far too often is administrators making curricular decisions, pulling texts that are educationally valuable from the classroom because of a few parents' complaints about the ideas expressed in them, oftentimes based on their moral values, also based on discomfort with the ideas discussed. And rather than suppressing or ignoring difficult or uncomfortable speech, we encourage more speech. We encourage educators to create spaces for more conversation about the uncomfortable topics so that students can confidently confront those ideas and come away with their own truths.
Well, in this case, you know, we have a Duluth chapter of the NAACP, mm-hmm. and they've actually come out in support of this decision because they feel like there is another way to have these conversations in the classroom without using books that refer to racial slurs. And I guess I'm interested to hear your take on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's unfortunate that the Duluth NAACP took that position so publicly, because it's disturbing on a couple fronts. Perhaps there may be other books that teach similar lessons, but that's not the issue, right? Teachers shouldn't be forced to choose which books suit their curriculum based on what makes parents and the public comfortable. When we remove books simply because the ideas make people uncomfortable, it deprive students of that right to access information and to confront what exactly it is about that word or that speech that is wrong, right? And one thing that what we advocate is for teachers to rather engage students to understand the historical context of racist language, to understand it in its contemporary context as well, because these words aren't antiquated in our vocabulary, right? People still use racist language in our society, and especially in this fraught moment in our nation's history where we still see white supremacist ideology being given a prominent platform and being given, you know, credence in some sections of society. We feel it's important for, just even more important for our young people to be afforded the freedom to read about and discuss racism, racist language, and racist ideas in their proper historical and contemporary contexts. And to be able to come away from these hopefully well-directed discussions with important lessons about the ills of slavery, about the evils of slavery, and why it is something we want to keep in our past and work to combat in our present and future.
Well, and one of the arguments that has been made by the president of the Duluth chapter of the NAACP is because racism and discrimination is alive and well in modern society and in even in our own communities, that there must be a better way to go about having these conversations than to subject students to language that makes them feel uncomfortable among their peers. Again, this is just go back to what you were saying, or what do you think about that?
I would be interested to know what other, you know, some of the other ways of discussing race that wouldn't make people uncomfortable. I think it is understandable if people are uncomfortable by racist language or feel uncomfortable with using racist language or hearing racist language. I think better that than students be desensitized to it and not appreciate their power. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center just released a report about the teaching of slavery in American schools, and they argue that we need to be discussing more about slavery and the vestiges of slavery and racism in our country today in American schools, and that we're not teaching enough about it, that rather than shying away from uncomfortable subject matter, we should be engaging it. We should be helping students to be able to confront it in a good classroom environment where they don't feel shame about it, but can feel a sense of empathy and also feel a sense of agency in the way that they respond to racist speech and the way that they navigate themselves in a racist society. So rather than not teaching children about antebellum Mississippi or not discussing the use of racist text in our history, or racist language in our history, I think we should rather be exploring it, examining it, and understanding why it is damaging to society.
Well, I'm curious if this is something that you are seeing more of, as you mentioned before, that we are seeing a lot of discussion about white supremacy and more open discourse about racism, you know, perhaps, as always said, it's always been there, but really kind of maybe a lack of acknowledgement among some people. And so as we've come to see examples of this more recently, are we seeing schools, are we seeing organizations looking at banning books like these that have, you know, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird, which have typically in the past been highly banned books anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that happening more often?
We are seeing a trend of parents and special interest groups challenging texts. And so there have been a lot of cases of where administrators have had to review books that are either classic parts of our literary canon, or are books that deal with maybe contemporary texts that deal with race, racism, sex, and sexuality, topics that some parents find uncomfortable or have a hard time talking to their children about. And in a lot of cases, actually, in most cases, the books are restored because after review, the administrators, the teachers that are reviewing these books that are teaching them and are going to be the ones having the conversations with students in the classroom, recognize their literary value. And they recognize that reading them in the classroom setting where they can properly interrogate the uncomfortable truths that are presented and help their students understand them in a proper context is more beneficial to students than attempting to conceal them with this cloak of taboo and intrigue. And also understanding that a lot of these themes are themes that young people confront, if not in their presently in their daily lives, will soon confront as young adults. And so it's important as educators to prepare them for that. And so in every case of a book challenge or potential censorship that we hear, we always respond and we always say the same thing. A book might make some people uncomfortable, but that does not mean that everyone should be deprived the right to read it. We encourage schools to adopt alternative assignment policies and practices so that a parent that wants to opt out of a particular assignment can have another text of comparable educational merit assigned to their child and without disrupting the curriculum. And I think that in Duluth's case, it would have been preferable, it would have been ideal if they had offered parents alternative assignments, the opportunity to opt out, while a review committee, a committee of educators, librarians, and in some cases, competent community members, reviews the text on the curriculum and makes a decision based on educational considerations for what books to teach the following term. But removing books simply because they make certain people uncomfortable or because they have invited challenges in the past is dangerous because it privileges the views of those people who are uncomfortable over those of educators who are trained and qualified to determine what is valuable in the classroom, what is educationally enriching for young people.
Again, you've been listening to Abena Hutchville with the National Coalition Against Censorship on the Duluth School District's decision to remove The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird from its required reading curriculum. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. Coming up next, we hear about UW-Superior's new strategic plan to promote equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus. Jarrell Benton is the university's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity Director. He spoke with me recently about development of that plan during his first year at UWS.
The first year at UWS has been, I would say, amazing. Of course, we had our challenges and our opportunities, and we really try to take advantage of those opportunities. So the first year has been spent, you know, engaging faculty, staff, students on issues and topics of equity, diversity, and inclusion. I came in with a charge to develop a strategic equity, diversity, and inclusion plan. So we took that opportunity. I didn't want this to be just a plan that came out of our department, but it's a campus-wide plan that kind of reaches across multiple divisions, multiple departments, multiple stakeholders. And so we engaged the campus from the standpoint we got buy-in from our shared governance. So we had representatives from each one of the governance groups on campus. And then also we had student representation on the group. And then, of course, the staff within the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion department was included in developing this plan. So the good majority of that first year was spent, you know, engaging those stakeholders and developing the goals, developing our definitions for diversity, inclusion, and equity on our campus, and just kind of developing a path forward for that work.
Well, and you recently unveiled this plan.
It's four goals, and each goal has a certain amount of strategies and tactics. So we tried to narrow the goals down as much as possible so we can have a very doable plan and that it's focused. So what you'll find with this strategic equity, diversity, and inclusion plan, which goes through the year 2020, is really establishing a foundation for equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus to where we're not only creating an environment that's welcoming and inclusive for everyone, but we're also creating an environment to where we can reach a better or stronger demographic across, you know, different races, different sexual orientations, sexuality, whatever it may be. So including our veteran and non-traditional student population. So you'll see within the plan, it covers, you know, a wide array of groups of people. So
what are the four goals then, or the main things that you're trying to accomplish?
So, yeah, so the four goals, broadly speaking, one is communication. So how are we demonstrating our commitment to equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus? So some of the things that we're kind of looking at within that goal is, you know, some of its visibility stuff, like in our facilities, how are we communicating or demonstrating that we're committed to equity, diversity, and inclusion. Also a part of that goal is the establishment of a bias incident response team so we can respond to bias incidents on campus. And that work has already actually began before the plan was even finalized. And then the second goal is assessment and implementation. And that is where we will be looking at how are we measuring the institutional growth surrounding equity, diversity, and inclusion. So we have a variety of assessment tools that we'll be utilizing to kind of monitor our growth. And then we're also going to use institutional data. We're also going to get qualitative data from various stakeholders, faculty, staff, and students to be able to tell a story about, you know, the growth that's happening and based off of the strategic goals and tactics that are a part of that. So one of our goals is to measure how well we're doing. And then goal three will be the recruitment and retention of faculty, staff, and students. And specifically on the student side, you know, how are we addressing equity gaps in when it comes to, you know, applications and admittance and enrollment? How are we addressing you know, the development of programs that are targeted towards specific groups of students? How are we assessing those programs? And then also, I would say from the faculty staff side, what are our strategic goals for the representation of faculty on campus? So there's one of the assessment tools that we're going to be utilizing is the affirmative action plan, which kind of looks at race, ethnicity, and gender. But at the same time, we don't want to settle just for, you know, those targeted populations, too. We understand that our faculty and staff have multiple identities. So do we have affinity groups that will be able to support a campus community that is quite diverse that may not be reflected in the larger Twin Ports community? And it's just a way for us to be able to attract new talent to the institution, and that we can have our faculty staff representation mirror that of our student representation. I think one of the things a lot of people don't know, when we take underrepresented minority students and international students and we kind of bring those two populations together, they make up about 20% of our student enrollment. So does our faculty and staff representation kind of mirror that? And at this point, it doesn't. So this goal is going to kind of help us move forward in defining what goals we want to set for our faculty, staff, workforce. And then the last goal of the plan is engagement and education, and that's where we're really focusing in on how are we engaging all students in the work of equity, diversity, and inclusion. We understand that as an institution, we have a responsibility for preparing our students to be able to interact and live in a global society. So this is where the plan gets really broad, and we're focusing in on avenues in which we can strategically place equity, diversity, and inclusion as part of the learning expectations for all students on our campus. And then also within that goal is how we engage in the community in that work as well. Our students are not just UWS students. They actually live in the community as well. So we want to take some of that responsibility to be able to work hand in hand with the community to, you know, whether it's through trainings, through whatever it may be, to, you know, make a better superior through some of the work that we're going to be doing, because our students are going to go into the grocery stores. They are going to go to the local Quick Trips. So, you know, what can we do to have an impact in that way? So those are the four goals that we're looking at.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about some of them. I mean, you in the first one, communication, you mentioned a bias incident response team.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that and what that's done? And
yes. So that group is we're actually getting ready to launch that group officially here in the next couple weeks. But that group is a group that's has individuals from Counseling and Health Services, the Department of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, the Dean of Students Office, Academic Affairs, and also like campus safety. But that group is charged, number one, we want it to be a preventative group, right? So we want to, as a group, talk about how can we educate our campus community on bias incidents or bias in general, bias stereotypes, discrimination, and bring awareness to that. But also a part of that, we have a reporting form that we are launching where faculty, staff, community members can report any incidents on campus. Now, this group is not a disciplinary group because we already have systems in place to deal with that. So if the incident occurs and it rises to the level that either the Dean of Students Office needs to be involved or the Human Resources Office needs to be involved, they will still handle that in those avenues. But this is really about supporting targeted individuals and helping them navigate that process. And then also for, you know, incidents that don't rise to the level of a conduct issue, it is about the education process. So how do we provide mediation between a targeted person and a respondent that may have committed a bias act, whether knowingly or unknowingly? But a lot of that is up to the targeted person. So if they don't want that type of mediation, then we don't do that type of mediation. But we do want to provide some support in that manner.
So what are some of the things that might happen related to that? Like if someone were to say something stereotypical or hurtful in some way to any race, color, creed, sexual orientation, what would take place? Or can you give me an example of how you might intervene to resolve that?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of different scenarios that you can consider. So let me just give you maybe a couple. So say, for instance, graffiti on a residence hall door or something of that nature that places a symbol that may be offensive to someone. And oftentimes we don't know who committed that act, right? So some of the strategies surrounding that is like maybe we need to do some community education if we can identify maybe a residence hall floor or maybe the entire residence hall, whatever it may be, we can engage in some educational components like that. Then from the other side of things, if say we do know and whether it was knowing or unknowingly, if the targeted person is willing to enter into some remediation, is bringing those two individuals together and being able to share, you know, how that made that individual feel and what are some of the things that we can do to try to move forward and also educate that individual on, you know, why that was hurtful for someone. So sometimes it is unknowingly, and then sometimes it's very outright, explicit. So, and at that point, we would think that would rise to a conduct level because, we want to make sure that we're communicating that we're serious about, mm-hmm. bias and discrimination on campus. And then there's going to be times where it is going to be more of an educational approach.
So if it rose to the level of discrimination or, something that, how does the university address it in terms of, of conduct if it goes against what?
Yeah, it still goes through our normal student conduct that's handled by through the Dean of Students Office. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, a couple of other things you mentioned were recruitment and retention of faculty, staff, and students in addressing equity gaps like mm-hmm. enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
How would this plan help address inequities possibly in enrollment?
Yeah, so some of the things that the working groups are talking about right now are like pre-college programs. So what are some areas, what are some opportunities that we can provide that allow for individuals from underserved populations to be able to come to our campus and not only just from a recruitment standpoint, but how can we help in the college ready initiatives that are happening, all across the United States? How can we communicate to students from underserved populations that college can be a goal for you? So sometimes some of that is about exposure, right? So so we're looking at opportunities to be able to get students from underserved populations to be on our campus for us to talk about different processes, not even just the students, the families as well. They need to know that college can be an option if that student choose, college as an option after high school. And then we're also kind of looking at specifically like cohort-based programming when we are bringing in some of our new students. How can we wrap our arms around and provide the supports necessary, whether it's academically, and then I think a lot of times we forget about the social aspect of it, socially. So how do we, bring those students in and kind of wrap our arms around them and provide them the necessary supports academically and socially to be successful at our institution?
Right, because I think most people will gravitate to or who they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that from some international students on campus, is they become friends with people they share similar backgrounds with. Mm-hmm. And so would this kind of seek to get people more intertwined on campus? Or?
Absolutely. Okay. So part of it is understanding that there are, from an equity standpoint, there are needs for additional supports for students. But also when we talk about, as I mentioned earlier, about preparing students for interacting in a global society, yes, it is about bringing a variety of different groups together to understand different perspectives, understand different worldviews and things of that nature. So we will be looking to bring multiple groups together across campus, across race, across sexual orientation, across, any identity to make people more aware and more understanding.
Just like through forums or events? Or
yep, it will be through forums and events. So we are looking to improve the events that we offer on campus that are targeted towards equity, diversity, and inclusion to do more campus-wide programming versus doing, maybe like smaller programming that may be coming out of one office. But what can we look to do as an institution that can bring the entire institution, together to have discussions surrounding these topics?
Okay. Well, and you also mentioned faculty and how 20% of the student population is international or underrepresented students,
mm-hmm.
but that the faculty, that we don't see the same mix.
Not at this point, no. We recognize that that's an area of improvement. So and that's why we ended up including it in our plan. Right now I believe our faculty, specifically just faculty, it makes up about 14%. Of the entire faculty body. It is about, like I said, affirmative action can, we can have target goals in affirmative action, but we need to have some institutional goals that may even supersede you know, affirmative action goals, and that's kind of what we want to shoot for.
So what would that look like then for faculty? I mean, I assume you would make changes in the hiring process, or how would that go?
So that's one of the things that the group is looking at. So we're looking at our policies and practices, kind of how we operate, how we run search committees, how we're doing all those things, to maybe look at, you know, do we need to change some things to. And one of the biggies that we're starting to work on is where and how we're advertising positions. So I put together a list of different places where we could start advertising. Yes, they do cost additional funds, but that's why we have a plan that's funded so we can do more work in that area. So reviewing policies, practices, and then also just doing more advertising in some very targeted locations is important.
So was there anything in developing the strategic plan that surprised you as you were talking to different groups on campus?
I wouldn't say that anything surprised me, because I believe that, you know, a lot of the things that we are looking at, I think a lot of institutions either have looked at or are looking at this point, specifically as demographics are changing in our nation. I mean, we're going to be ever evolving, ever-changing institution, just because, you know, society is changing. So I don't think there's anything that stood out. I will say one of the things that stood out as something to celebrate is the amount of commitment that we had all the way from Chancellor Walker all the way down to our students and wanting to see some change when it comes to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and then the institution to actually back that up you know, by adopting this plan and funding this plan.
So you're talking about funding. I guess what level of support is there for this plan to carry out some of the initiatives that you've laid out or the goals?
So, yeah, so the institution has committed over the next 3 years $150,000. You know, we're working on figuring out how those funds will be dispersed based off of the initiatives and programs that will come out of this plan. So we have a large group of folks working in working groups, identifying, you know, what are the targeted things that we want to accomplish over these next 3 years, and then we'll allocate those funds as we see necessary.
So what do you want to see happen, I guess, in the near future? Like, what are the steps that you want to take to move forward on this plan?
We're going to start with some simple stuff by even just looking at our facilities and making sure that our facilities are promoting and communicating a representation of the people to actually walk in the buildings. Not to say that we're doing a bad job at that at all. But there are some places where we identified some gaps, and those are easy fixes, right? So whether it's through like decorations, signage, whatever that may be, so people can, you know, feel welcomed in the environment that they're going to be in.
Can you be more specific, I guess, about what you mean as far as like promoting and representing?
Yeah. So walking in a building, I mean, the culture of artwork is something that I think a lot of people I think we take for granted. So when we look at like our publications and when we look at, you know, the things that we hang up in our walls and our offices and things of that nature, what are some things that we can do that will be able to communicate to students that, hey, we see you on our campus and we want you to be represented, you know, whether it's on our walls and our offices and things of that nature. I mean, a prime example, and I think this is one area we do a really good job, is in the Yellow Jacket Union. If you ever walked in there and you've seen all the international flags that represent every student that, you know, came to our institution from another country, you know, we get a lot of comments on that. And I think a lot of people take for granted how much that means to some individuals. But when they walk in there, you know, and they see their flag represented, it's a sense of pride. So we're even looking at really small details such as that. So, you know, that's one of the things that we're looking at kind of moving forward. You know, recently we partnered with communications and marketing in the photo shoot and made sure we had diverse representation in some of the photo shoot that was going on campus. So, you know, some of the smaller things and sometimes no cost, you know, are things that we're kind of looking at that we can just kind of grab on early on. But a lot of the programs and initiatives that are being developed are still being talked about in the working group phase. We know that we're going to do things in these goal areas, but the very specifics and how we execute those things are still being worked out.
So when do you plan to begin executing some of the goals within the plan?
Actually,
right now.
Yep. Because, like I said, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be making an announcement regarding the bias incident response team that will go out to all faculty staff and students on how to report, what to expect when you report, and things of that nature. So, you know, we have some things that we had already in the fire that we're already moving. And then there's some things that just naturally has to take a lot more planning because we're talking about a change in culture and a change in practice.
So why is this so important? I know that seems like a no-brainer, but just to, you know, why is it so important to have programs targeted towards diversity, equity, and inclusion?
And just like I said, we're preparing students for a global society. And I think we will be doing a disservice if we did not offer those opportunities for students to be able to engage in any type of work of equity, diversity, and inclusion, because it's only preparing them to be able to function in a society once they leave our institution. And I tell the students all the time, this is probably the best opportunity that you're ever going to have to be able to be around such a diverse group of people, unless you go work for Google or Facebook or somewhere like that, because I don't think you ever find organizations that are going to be as diverse, not just in racial diversity, but in other forms of diversity as well, including life experience, right? When we talk about the 40% of our over 40% of our student population are non-traditional students over the age of 25 or have families or are married and they're in our classroom. So how do we capitalize off of that? How do our traditionally age students learn from those experiences? So I don't think there ever will ever be in a students will ever be in a opportunity, like I said, to be able to be in such a diverse environment. So I think one of the key pieces and what we try to focus on is within this plan is to be student-centric and preparing our students to be successful. And then from the equity lens is to make sure that we are doing our role in ensuring that students from underserved populations are successful.
And what do you hope people take away from this process, whether they're on campus or off?
Yeah, number one, I hope that people are able to take from this process would be everybody brings a piece of diversity to the table and everybody has a story. So through this process and hearing from faculty, staff, and students, we learned about different people's stories. And everybody has a story. And as a large organization such as ours, I want us to be able to kind of dive into those stories and be able to learn and grow. But ultimately, as an institution, what I hope we learn from this process is that, you know, we have some work to do in this area, just like every other institution, and that we can continue this movement forward and to making sure that we create equitable spaces for all faculty, staff, and students to be able to be successful in their jobs or to be successful as a student.
Anything else that I'm missing that you want to add, Jarrell?
No, like I said, I'm excited, even though some of the work is being developed. There was a large group of folks that took a lot of time and energy in developing this plan, and we're looking forward to kind of seeing it through. We want to be committed to it, and we will be committed to it, and, you know, hopefully we'll be back talking about some awesome programs that will be upcoming in the future, to where we are engaging people in the community, we're engaging our students in a different way.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Jarrell.
Thank you.
Again, you were just listening to UW Superior's Jarrell Benton about the university's new strategic plan to promote equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus. Before we end our program, the City of Superior approved the creation of a Community of Color Commission this week. Superior's mayor has appointed four people to serve on the commission, including Kim Young. She says the commission is needed to move the city forward as a more diverse, accepting community.
Pulling us all together and creating the foundation for what we term as the beloved community that Dr. King spoke of. It's all of us acting in unison and all of us coming together to make our community better, and this is part of that.
Young says one of her priorities for the commission will be to do more to attract and retain people of color in Superior.
Our communities of color are pretty transient right now. If they can't make it in Superior within 6 months, they usually leave. And we like to see young families start to stay here. We need to increase job opportunities, housing opportunities, and educational opportunities for not only the white citizens of Superior, but also for the communities of color here.
Superior Mayor Jim Payne says the creation of the commission is long overdue.
People of color live in this community. They have every bit as much value as every other citizen in this community. We also need to recognize that they haven't been treated that way. And there are some very real systemic and direct inequalities and injustices that are perpetuated against people of color in this community.
Natasha Loncour, Stefan Witherspoon, and Jarrell Benton will also serve on the commission. Next week, I will join People of Color host Henry Banks and members of the commission to talk about its creation and some of the issues the group would like to examine in Superior. That program will air on People of Color next Thursday evening at 6 on WPR stations. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. We hope you can join us the next two Fridays as we air fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from the 8th annual Writers Read event held recently at Northland College in Ashland. Writers from the Twin Ports and the Shawangan Bay area read their original works before a live audience on the theme of gut instinct. The project is a collaboration between Northland College, WPR, and Aqueous Magazine. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Enjoy the weekend.